On the 12th of December last year, we officially launched the Kickstart Garage. To date, we've published over 50 episodes, racked up more than 5,000 downloads, published more than 30 hours of content, and listeners have tuned in from more than 14 countries. The feedback over the past year has been incredible, and it's been really appreciated. We're glad you're enjoying the show and getting something from it. To all our listeners, we want to thank you for tuning in. Without your interest and support, we wouldn't be where we are today. Overall, our mission is to provide credible mentorship through elite practitioners. We wouldn't have been able to execute on this if it wasn't for the generosity of our guests giving up their time to talk to a couple of nobodies for the guts of an hour. We also want to give a special shout out to Gareth Flower, also for initially presenting us with a great partnership opportunity to collaborate with the Magnate 100 community very early on in our journey. Magnate 100 is filled with ambitious entrepreneurs that are as helpful as they are successful. It's been a privilege getting to sit down and chat with the members of the Magnate 100 community. Again, thank you to all the listeners who have shared our content, provided us with feedback, and reached out to give us a few kind words over the past year. It's been really, really appreciated. I'm going to hand you over now to Gavin, who's going to close out the show for the year.
Thank you very much, Sam. Yeah, fantastic year. We had some really brilliant guests on, each with, you know, different stories to share, different journeys, and certainly various lessons learned along the way. Really enjoyed it. So what we want to do on today's show, we thought we'd finish up by recapping some of the best bits with our guests over the past year. So we're going to do this in two parts, with the second part releasing next Sunday. What you're about to hear are 13 separate clips from our first 13 guests. Hopefully you enjoy, and we will see you soon.
I wanted to congratulate you, Pamela. You know, of course, being such an inspiration for young Irish entrepreneurs, but specifically for females, you know, who are out there in Ireland looking to succeed in business and entrepreneurship in general, which it is largely male dominated. What advice would you give to young business enthusiasts out there looking to make it as an entrepreneur?
I think if I could go back and give myself some advice, it would be get as much experience as you can, you know, asking questions. Like the people that reach out to me now, I'm thrilled to be able to tell them anything that I can that might help them, you know, get 6 months on the right track instead of going down the wrong way or whatever it might be. And so looking for help and guidance will really set you far. And even just, you know, Magnate, the group we're in, all of these things that are out there to support entrepreneurs, like, go for them. Like, don't be afraid, don't be shy. You're never too early stage to start talking to people. And I think it definitely would have accelerated my, you know, career more if I had done that earlier. And because you kind of think you can do it and no one will help you, but actually people will help you. And I think another thing that I always even have to tell myself day to day is that, you know, if you're scared, you're probably on the right track. You know, if it's all nice and everything is great, you're not moving and you're not taking enough of a risk, within reason obviously. But when I'm the most scared or unsure is generally where the success happens and where the big deals happen. And so you want big deals when you're an entrepreneur, so really push yourself. And just, it's not about what you do first, you do everything at the same time when you're an entrepreneur. No, there's no first step, second step. It's literally like you throw it all out there and you hope something sticks, and that's just what it's about. And I think just going for it and getting as much help as you can would be my two pieces of advice.
Another tweet that you recently put out there, Paddy, you tweeted that becoming skilled at YouTube is essentially becoming skilled at predicting human behavior. Do you want to elaborate on that tweet if you don't mind? I mean, does psychology play a really big part in your client strategy consultations?
Yeah, like the more I think about what I do, the more I think about the amount of times I say in my head, how will the viewer view this? Or how will they see this? Or how will this person in this position who's never seen my channel before find the opening of my video? So I think it's about predicting how people will interact with a certain piece of content. And like I've done a bit of work and so like I've read a few books in psychology. It was always an interest in school. I did a few modules on it when I was in college. And I just found like a lot of the stuff I learned from those books just started to make a lot more sense when I applied them to YouTube. One of my original career paths that I was thinking about going down was to be like an organizational psychologist or someone that worked in like business psychology or even sports psychology, because I thought it was so interesting. And I think when I think about the decisions, like, sure, there's lots of technical stuff. Like, there's like hard skills of like, can you make a good thumbnail? But here's the thing. The best graphic designer in the world, the best, the person that can make the most incredible looking thumbnails is not the best thumbnail designer, or is not the best person to make a thumbnail, because they might not understand like what text to use, or maybe what facial expression would generate the most interest in the audience. And that's where the psychology comes in. So much of what I do is like testing things. So let's say someone uses a certain expression in a thumbnail. Does that lead to a higher CTR than a different expression? And then when you compound that with enough data, you kind of get some conclusions from that you can say, okay, in general, this is a rule that I can stick to. When you use this expression, it works better. When you use this color, it works better than this color and whatnot. At the end of the day, that just comes down to human preference and human psychology. Like, are you more intrigued by someone who's got an angry expression or someone that's smiling? You know, for example, one of the best expressions on YouTube for clicks is confusion. So if you look kind of confused in your thumbnail, people click and they're like, why is he confused? Like, what's happening? I need to see this. But if you're just smiling and posing like a headshot, it's kind of boring.
A lot of people, and this is my final question for you today, Evan, before we let you go, a lot of people choose investing as a strategy towards retirement, as well, of course, as building some generational family wealth. That's the long-term principle for a lot of people. Do you have a personal, like, long-term purpose behind your investment strategy, or a point at which you would simply retire from investing, or just shift everything to be a completely passive portfolio and focus on other things in life? Or would you always be, you always want to be around it?
No way, man. For me, stock investing goes far beyond wealth creation or some kind of hobby.
You'd say that.
Yeah. No, this is like, stock investing is a comprehensive, unending stream of lessons. Like, stock investing teaches you about the behavior of everybody else, how humankind responds to world events or company specific news. It teaches you about new industries and even old businesses doing something that you never even heard of. You learn about how you respond to trouble, and it also teaches you how to respond the next time. Like, stock investing unlocks a deeper sense of purpose, I suppose. And it ultimately allows you to help others, be that through teaching or economically. So, and the great thing about stock investing is it demands nothing. You can take a week or a month or a year off and return as you would to, say, a musical instrument, and pick up where you left off. And that is why I love it.
An element that I've struggled with is the assessment of the company's management team. I've actually picked up a few bits from watching you doing deep dives over on YouTube, such as checking out the Glassdoor reviews, which I think is really, really smart. Could you talk to us a little bit about how you go about the assessment of a company's management team?
Yeah, management is a huge factor in finding a good investment, because they're the ones that are making all the capital allocation decisions. They're the ones that are hiring. They're the ones that are in control of the policies. They're the ones that shape the corporate culture, launch new products, etc. Their decisions making make or break the company. They are 100% responsible for execution. And it's execution which drives financial results, and financial results drives the stock price. So they're critically important. As outside, as individual investors, it's not like you can call up the CEO of a company and say, "Hi, I want to interview you. I have some questions for you." That's not something that we can do. So, how do you judge them? Thankfully, today it's never been easier to be able to judge management teams. Although it's not necessarily easy, right? So on my checklist, I devote 14 points to management. I think it's important. And there's a few shortcuts that I think that investors can use so that you never have to meet or talk to the CEO, but you can judge whether or not they're doing a good job. The first thing I look at is their tenure. How long have they been at that company for? The best answer there is, I founded it, right? I founded the company. Founders are like a cheat code to investing, because if you found a company and it goes all the way to being on the public markets, there's no way you're not ridiculously wealthy. Like, there's no way you are not already ridiculously wealthy. You have at least $5 million, more like 50, 100, or maybe even $1 billion. Like, you are set up financially for the rest of your life. If you were set up financially for the rest of the life, why would you be a public CEO? There has to be some other reason why you are interested in doing that. And a lot of founders found companies in the first place because they see an opportunity or they see a problem and they are passionate about fixing it. So I love to bet on founders. Second reason I love to bet on founders is because the board and the investors generally give that founder a lot of leeway to operate the company how the founder sees fit. And occasionally, companies have to make big, bold bets on new ventures. And if the CEO is a hired gun, a lot of times they have to do a lot of convincing to get the rest of the board and stuff on board. But if they're the founder, a lot of times the market gives them the ability to do so. A famous recent example was Reed Hastings, at Netflix in 2011, when he basically said, "We're going all in on streaming. We're essentially killing our DVD by mail business, and we are going 100% in on streaming." That's a bold bet. That is a really hard thing to do. But the market gave him the ability to make that pivot. The stock fell 85% in the short term, but he still had the gumption to do so. So I allocate points based on. So best case scenario, they founded the company. Second best case scenario is they've spent their entire career there. And third best case scenario is they've been there at least 5 years. I don't like it when new CEOs are brought in because that's like a wild card. And new CEOs don't always mesh with the corporate culture and they can screw things up. So that's one thing, just tenure. The second thing I look at is skin in the game. How much of the stock do they personally own? Essentially, I want, if that stock goes down, I, the shareholder, get hurt. I want them to be hurt way more. I want them, their finances to feel it way more than mine. So I want to see millions, at least millions of dollars in stock on the line. Third, as you pointed out, I like to check Glassdoor. Glassdoor is, again, kind of like a cheat code for investors these days. I mean, who knows a CEO better than the people that work for them? Who feels the pain of that CEO's decisions more than the people that work for them, right? And they will go on Glassdoor and they will be completely honest about what they like or don't like about CEOs. So side note, if you just go on Glassdoor's highest rated CEOs list and look for public companies, that's a pretty good shopping list right there. Finally, I judge a company by their communication skills. And one of the most important communication skills that they have beyond shareholder letters and how they talk in transcripts and how they do in interviews, is the mission statement of the company. I'm a big, big, big believer in mission statements, which are kind of like, a mission statement is like a North Star for a company. Like if you have a really good mission statement, it aligns all of the stakeholders of a business. So that would be employees, management, shareholders, suppliers, society, around that one target. And if that target is inspirational, that just shows that the management team is really good at communication skills. So I think between tenure, ownership, employee ratings, and communication skills, that will give you a really good sense of whether the management team is doing a good job or not.
I just want to pivot over here now for a moment, and we'll talk a bit more about outrage marketing. And in my opinion, I believe this is the secret sauce of the White Moose Cafe, because It's not a very replicable strategy for established businesses to adopt, and it's quite hard to implement in a sense too. It's a strategy that you would you'd need to have embedded from inception. But I'll get your thoughts on that statement in just a moment. But for people that haven't heard of the strategy, could you talk to us about the premise of outrage marketing and how it made a small cafe in Phibsborough known so well globally?
Well. Firstly, let me say that it's not as if on one particular day in 2017 I was, you know, sitting on the toilet and I thought, light bulb moment, let's piss people off and let's get money for doing it. Or I didn't kind of have a magic wand that I waved and out came this concept of outrage marketing. It kind of just happened naturally. And again, you know, we call it this term outrage marketing, but it's not because I termed it that or I even set out to make it what it is. It's, again, it happened because I was honest in what I did, you know. So, for example, you know, when I put a letter of response to that blogger who was asking for 5 free nights over the Valentine's period in exchange for some exposure on her social channels. That was just an honest reply by me, you know. And when I put up the post to vegans, attention vegans, please don't waltz in here and look at us as if we've 100 heads when there aren't 50,000 items on our menu to suit your idiosyncratic dietary requirements. That again is honesty. When I asked for a doctor's note for gluten-free food, because people come in claiming that they're intolerant to gluten when they're actually not celiacs. And, you know, I don't know if you're aware of this, but if you're not celiac, gluten has neither a detrimental nor a beneficial effect on your health at all. So, despite the fact that all I'm saying is the truth and all I'm being is honest, because of the climate we live in these days, people are outraged by the truth because of this cripplingly PC world we're in. And that outrage translates into people talking badly about us. For example, look at the white moose. What kind of a cafe is this? He is a prick. He's a misogynist. He's a xenophobe. He's a racist. Oh, I'm never going there. I'll never darken their doors. And these are all tweets promoting us to a following. So let's say I tweet, look at what the White Moose Cafe did. Aren't they terrible? Right. My friends who see that tweet might look at the tweet and say, well, actually, no, he's not that bad, really. I actually find it kind of funny. And then they actually may end up becoming customers of ours simply because I originally told the truth, which outraged people. So, you know, you might think, oh, well, Paul Stenson hates vegans, or Paul Stenson, you know, pokes fun at this, that and the other. I don't really. All I do is tell the truth. But because of the world we live in these days, it has an outrage effect, which in turn creates cash. So that's what outrage marketing is. I'm not really doing anything wrong. I'm just being honest.
Yeah, it's really interesting because it's not you kind of say that made the strategy, but it's really the people themselves that kind of created it. It's because it's up to the other party, obviously, to take offense for whatever you put out there, right?
Offense is taken, not given.
Yeah, exactly. So it's, yeah, like it's them creating the monster.
I also understand you're a big fan of Darren Hardy. I've heard you mention his book a couple of times on other podcasts, and I've actually only finished reading it myself. It was the Compound Effect, and it's a great book, and it's very motivational. With that said, what motivates you to get up in the morning, and how can others find similar motivation?
To take the cheesy answer, I would say, to be part of the exception rule, now to quote Darren Hardy. Generally, like, what motivates me is getting up, doing a good day's work, being true to the values that we have in the company in terms of looking after our clients, candidates and personnel, and really giving a good service. And at the end of the day, when I reach the pearly gates, it's a case of, I don't want anybody saying he was a bit of a naff guy, you know. I'd like for people to think that he was a nice guy. He'd give back, he always give his time to everybody. And to me, that'd be the perfect ending, you know.
Give, as Gary Vee would always say as well.
Yeah. Well, I think if you give, it always tends to come back, and it comes back in spades as compared to what you give. People genuinely do appreciate the time you give them. I'm sure you guys appreciate the time I give you for the podcast. I'm sure there's guys that reach out to me on LinkedIn and I jump in a Zoom for 15 or 20 minutes to answer a few questions for them. Like, it's no big deal to me, but there's a sense of a little bit of self-gratification as well in that you're actually helping somebody. But the impact you're having on the people that are asking or reaching out is huge, and you probably don't realize at the time. Yeah, so yeah, I would always be that kind of giver's game. You know, that's the way it is.
In advance of this podcast, I was watching a ton of sales videos, and one that struck me was a vlog from Gary Vee on the best strategy to increase sales was the title of the video. I think it was episode 427 of Daily V or something.
That's impressive. You know the episode.
I'm a numbers guy. But for those that want to check that's for those who want to check it out anyway. But in it, he quotes, the best way to sell in the world
is to have the customer come to you without you doing anything.
Mm.
And since starting this podcast, we've had people reaching out asking for investment guidance, tax advice, everything.
Nice.
And when I heard Gary say that, it really kind of hit home with me. You know, brand is a powerful tool to increase sales, and it comes in the form of the content you produce, you know, that free value proposition you put out there. And just, I was just wondering if I could get your thoughts on using brand to increase sales, because I see you posting a load of, you know, clips from the podcast there recently on LinkedIn. And I was wondering, what advice could you offer to those looking to build either their own personal brand or their company brand?
I like Gary Vee too. I'd probably respond to it with something Gary Vee would say. And actually, I'll start out with this. To get anyone's attention, to get anyone to take action, you must first get their attention. And a great way to get people's attention is to focus on building a brand. I start with knowing your audience and finding out things that they're interested in, and then where your audience take place. So the first one is knowing your audience and things they're interested in or pains they have. Really easy. Gartner and the likes of those kind of companies will come out with a annual report on kind of the top 10 to 15 pains of said specific role, whatever role you are. If you're a CRO or CFO or whatever, they'll come out with the top kind of 10 to 20 pains, so you can understand what your target demographic are interested in learning about. So once you understand that and where you can add value to those 10 to 20 pains, then find out where your target prospects spend their time. If it's B2B, could be LinkedIn. If it's B2C, it could be Instagram, it could be Facebook. But find out where they spend their time, because you don't want to be wasting your time spending time where they're not spending their time. And with a combination of those two, we're creating good content targeted towards those 10 to 20 pains in the right place. You can build an incredibly powerful brand. And then I did start this question or answering this question with saying I reference Gary Vee, and the reference to Gary Vee would be to give, and then get. So that's the whole, like, just keep giving content, building familiarity. And then when you've built familiarity, then you can ask, and you will, and I have evidence to back this up, and sounds like you guys have evidence to back this up as well, you will get more business.
I can see from your site that you specialize in SEO alongside web design. And for anyone new to the space, you know, that's search engine optimization. It's basically all about getting your website, you know, ranking better in the search engines like Google. The only trick is that it's pretty hard. And I say that from personal experience. So let's say someone listening to this podcast who has a site and wants to improve their search engine positioning, so say generate more traffic, leads, sales, what advice could you offer them?
That's the golden question when it comes to SEO, really, is that a lot of people will give you a not answer because no one really knows, to be honest with you. There's lots of different ways you can go about it. Obviously, without giving away the keys to the kingdom, there's lots of different methods. Speed for your site is probably the biggest one at the minute. Google loves speed, so the faster your site is, the better. So for that, you'd want caching, you'd want your images optimized, you'd want a CDN, Content Delivery Network. GTmetrics.com is a good site to measure your basic, your overall speeds, and it'll give you a breakdown on how to improve it. Just after speed, you'd have things like, basically, you'd want original content. Google doesn't want repetitive content that you just, you know, pull off of somewhere else. Other than that, you build your backlinks, you could do some PR, for example, as you can imagine, for us specifically, we don't have to work a whole pile on our SEO because we have a backlink on every single site we do. So you can imagine over 10 years, the amount of sites we've created, the amount of backlinks we have on the internet is massive. So as you can imagine, then you do some PR with, let's say, the Irish Independent, the Irish Times, you know, sites that would have massive authority online. Those PR backlinks will be worth more than, say, if Sam launched a website in the morning, you know, because Google won't have any idea what that is. So if you can build those backlinks up, that'll help with your SEO. There's a good tool as well on Moz.com for your domain authority. Now, your domain authority is basically going to rank how high Google will give you a score for a site. So, for example, the domain authority of Avalanche is 70. The Avalanche Designs.ie, that domain. that's built up over years. That's, you know, 70 out of 100 is a great score. You can look, like, Facebook, for example, is 92. Like Google, Facebook, Twitter, they're huge sites. They're all in the 90s. So the majority of Irish sites will be down around 20 or 30 when it comes to, like, a domain authority score. So if you can build that up through, like, your backlinks, your speed, your content, they're pretty much the three kind of pillars, really, I aim for SEO. And obviously, you need a bit of luck as well, because if someone tells you they know everything about SEO, they're lying to you. Because I don't think even the guys at Google know 100%. But yeah, like I said, I hope that's a bit more informative than a lot of the SEO answers I hear on most podcasts I listen to.
I kind of just want to move over here now to talk a bit more strategically about Fleming Real Estate. So throughout your career, you've had a lot of experience handling acquisitions, disposals, planning, redevelopment, and asset management. And I was wondering, when did you feel confident enough to take the leap to go out and do this on your own? And could you talk to us about the bridge between employed to self-employed and the early days of setting up Fleming Real Estate and what those were like?
I suppose going out on my own was always a goal from the minute I went to college. I always had it in my head that I wanted to go out on my own. Exactly what I wanted to do was a little bit up in the air, but I knew that I wanted to work for a year or two, get a little bit of experience and go out on my own. And I think my career choice first off the bat, a lot of my colleagues would have gone and worked for a lot of the commercial companies like CBRE and Savills. I kind of pretty much said that's not what I wanted to do. I wanted to get, like, kind of more hands-on experience. And I went and worked for Tesco because I knew I'd get really good hands-on experience in terms of actually what real life was about in terms of the property market from a development point of view, from a planning point of view. You'd get to see projects go from ground all the way to finish to asset managing them as well. So my goal was to go in there, spend maybe 2-3 years, learn everything I possibly could, get chartered and go out on my own. And at the time, I was probably thinking about going out more on my own from an investment and development point of view. And we're talking about kind of 2006, 2007, when I was kind of getting the confidence to go out on my own first off. And I decided to seek some loan approvals. It was much easier back then. And I went to go invest in a few properties. And I bid on a few investment properties, a few development projects as well. And luckily enough, at the time, I was outbid every single time. They just didn't meet my criteria in terms of where the bidding was going, because if I had landed one or two of those deals, they would have been back in 2007 at the height, and I would have been crushed completely going out on my own at that time. So decided not to. I left Tesco for a while, kind of regathered myself, eventually went back and worked for IBRC and learned a lot there. I learned what not to do. Realistically, what not to do. And in terms of setting out on my own, it was always a goal. So while I was working for Jones Lang, I was really just kind of trying to get the confidence back to go out on my own, as well as making sure the timing in regards to the market was correct and in terms of taking that risk. So it was more of a combination of feeling confident about going out on my own, as well as feeling that I had the kind of resources to swallow a kind of a year or two without kind of not having a huge amount of income coming in. And when those two matched up, that's when I kind of decided I would go out on my own. And I've really enjoyed it. I wouldn't look back for one second.
Talk to us about like starting a business when you were still in school. So like I mentioned there a minute ago, my brother's he's in sixth year. And if he told us he was starting and launching a business around like the Leaving Cert, I'd say my parents would just kill him. Like, did you find it difficult that you were like, you know, juggling loads of plates in those early stages?
Yeah, like one of the key things I would say to kind of young people starting off the business, whether it's in college or still in secondary school, is you have to keep the parents on side, because if the parents aren't happy, then nothing's going to get done, like, you know, because the last thing you want is you to be out in the office and then your parents to be upset that you're out in the office all the time, and then because they're upset you don't want to go home, and that just makes the issue worse, like, you know. So at all costs, you keep the mother and father on side, like, but like balancing it. At that time, I was kind of doing a lot of video work, and to be honest with you, it wasn't really that balanced. It was a lot swayed by Sneaker Cleaner and by the video work, and it was just a bit of a weird situation because I remember failing a business exam, but I had a pair 10 pairs of shoes and a Louis Vuitton bag in my locker, like, you know, and walking around with a fair bit of cash in the wallet. And it just didn't really make sense. So I always kind of had that that kind of feeling that, okay, yeah, this kind of has to happen now, and it's kind of part of the process. But I reckon I'll be all right once I get out. You know, I'm not really too worried. But I still ended up getting into a Savage course that I'm really proud of getting into, and that was mostly because my mom forced me to do the portfolio, because once again I was working, heading to work, and then she dragged me out of bed the night before it was due, and got all the stuff together, and I did pretty well and got in.
And just on the discussion of exit multiples, I know there's many analysts that believe that startups can't be valued, like the biggest challenge being that many of them haven't got well-established operations with predictable cash flow patterns. And so I was wondering, what do you believe are the most important factors when you're looking at valuing a startup? And or would you concede with the narrative that it's would you concede with the narrative over numbers?
It's difficult. There's no two ways about it. It is tricky, and you can probably understand that every investee that comes to us has an overinflated idea of their own valuation, and so we have to kind of look at everything in the round, and you know, so we take some guidance from some of the other investors that have gone into it as well, of course, but we also construct our own kind of opinion as to what that might be. So when I say other investors, that could be Enterprise Ireland, for example. So if they've gone through a competitive start fund, the CSF round with Enterprise Ireland, that would have gone in for 50,000 for 50,000 for 10% investment. So that is valuing the business at €500,000. So that's a good place as any to start. And if people have gone on from the CSF and developed and shown that they've grown their business, shown that they've developed their app or whatever it happens to be that they've got, then absolutely we can see, okay, well, there's more value gone into the business since that CSF round. Okay, but is it now worth 750 or a million or 3 million or 7 million? These are the things that we have to look at. And we look at it, as I say, well, would we invest at that level into that business at this stage? And if we wouldn't, then, well, sorry, guys. If you won't move from that inflated valuation, then you're not going onto our platform. So, yes, it is difficult. We do have many criteria to look at to try and ascertain a line in the sand. But it's not us that is dictating what that is. The business actually is the way that is dictating the valuation. If we think it's ludicrous, then they're just not getting onto the site. If we think it's there or thereabouts, we will put it in front of our investors. And it's our investors that decide whether it's a good valuation or not. They will look at it and go, okay, yeah, no, I'm happy to take a punt at that valuation. It looks sensible. I can see the market size. I can see the strong team. I can see all of these elements that go to make that valuation plausible. And investors will invest, or they might not, and in which case then the company goes, well, okay, maybe my valuation was too high, and that's why I've got no investment. And that's another strong reason, why you need to be conservative in your estimation of the valuation of the business, particularly at this early stage.
I was wondering though, outside Morgan, do you have your own specific investment strategy when it comes to crypto?
Buy low, sell high. That's pretty much it. It comes down to a couple of things. It comes down to, so you look for the technical prowess of the project, right? You look for the amount of people that are backing it. So when you see a Telegram group with a lot of people that are pushing it, that's a good sign. You're looking for the market cap of a coin. You're looking for how many coins are being minted. So I don't know if you know Shibu Coin. Became the 11th best fucking asset in the world, or the 11th biggest crypto asset in the world. And it was one of those things where we put some cash into it early on. I put 500 quid into it, would have made a mine. and that turned into $3,000. And I was like, look, let's just cash out. We've made some money on this joke dog coin thing. That's grand. And we did that. Now, the total circulating supply of Shiba coin is 100 quadrillion tokens. Now, I don't know if you've ever seen that many zeros. It's a lot of zeros, right? So it could never reach a penny. So if it was to reach a penny, it would be worth, is it four trillion, which is 25% more than the current entire market cap of crypto. So don't invest in shit coins. I look for things with that solve problems the same ways you invest in any business. And that's kind of what they are. Like, the projects are businesses. So QNT is one of the ones that I really like. It's an overledger. I really like Link, Dot, which, like, it's so early in the crypto game that the chains don't even talk to each other. So you can't move it from one chain to another. You have to use a bridge, and there's all these other things. And it's really messy. So Dot is solving that. Ethereum is quite good. I think it's a really good store of value.
Yeah, ice cream is a very competitive market to be in. I mean, you know, suppliers have bargaining power, consumers have bargaining power, there's low barriers to entry, and the list goes on. Yeah, you seem to be striving in the face of that. So I was wondering, could you give us, like, what was your biggest struggle since starting the business, and how did you overcome that?
The biggest struggle, I was honestly, I think that moment when I set up the food truck and trailer is probably up there with one of my biggest regrets, because, like, I'm still paying for it to this day. But I've lived from that experience that, you know, enjoy the people that you work for, trust your gut about experiences and stuff like that. So whoever you work with, trust your gut. But that would be my biggest kind of tip to anyone is, if you have a feeling about someone, something, some location, it's probably true. Don't let your head, like, and the whole concept of monetary gain outweigh your primordial instinct, let's say, because of, you know there's something up here, but trust your gut is basically what I'm saying with that. But the biggest struggle, I think, for me, probably cash flow would be a big one. Like, I'm, again, financially inept. I have no concept really of finances at all. So it's quite difficult for me to wrap my head around it sometimes. And again, starting from, I was cycling to meetings, I didn't drive. And again, I was staying on friends' couches, and I was hot. Like, whenever I got a shipment of delivery of boxes and tubs, I had to hide them in fields because I had nowhere to store them. And, you know, so that was quite difficult at the very start, to just even pluck up the kind of motivation to just keep going and keep driving. Again, I couldn't even drive at the time as well, but now I can. But, you know, I didn't have a car or anything at the start, so I needed to keep pushing myself to say, it's like, okay, if I keep working at this, I come up with a plan, this is how it's going to unfold. And if I get it wrong, I get it wrong, I can try something else. So that's the early days for me was the hardest moment, because it was personal issues and cash flow issues as well. I didn't have a loan. I couldn't get out of a loan because obviously the bank wouldn't. I had no concept really, you know, because until you hit the market stalls, and then just setting it up and saving up all my money. And, you know, that would have been the biggest struggle from now on. But, like, again, like, anything that comes across my path now, I know what it's like to be, like, scraping pennies at the very bottom. So I know, like, and again, for any entrepreneur that's going through a struggle of a moment, those moments do pass, and you're going to just have an unwavering amount of self-belief, not ego or arrogance, but more, and humbleness to an extent, but more like self-belief that anything, that moment will pass. And that would be the biggest struggle for me. Like, yes, there's been awful moments where things have blown up. I've been electrocuted to the point where I got blown back about 5 feet, you know what I mean? And, like, you know, a lot of stuff, I've knocked out my tooth, like, in work and by hitting it off something, and I've hurt my hands and all sorts, you know what I mean? I've put my back out. So those are the struggles. Those are the short-term struggles. So I know that when you're at the bottom, that, like, when you go through something, you can get through it if you just have perseverance, self-belief, and you really just use that intrinsic motivation more than anything, that you can aspire to be a lot better. So anyone that's listening to this, if you're going through a struggle, going through a hard time,
it does pass, but you need to have a lot of self-belief in yourself to make sure that you do get through it. Because if you don't have that self-belief that you can get through it, it will fall apart and things will just get worse and worse. I've noticed that myself when I've stopped in my self-belief and things get bad, things get worse because you stop acting on it, let's say, and trying to work to make it better because, you know, your self-belief is gone. But then once you pluck up that to get back, that's when things start to come a bit better. Do you get what I mean? So it's not necessarily the, because everything, especially in the food industry, things go wrong the whole time. As I said, things blow up, people don't show up, machines will break on your busiest ever day. You'll be catering for 14 to 2,000 people at a private event and your staff don't show up, or, you know, you've run out of stock and you look like an absolute mug. But, you know, so these things do happen, and that's the beauty of running the business. You just kind of take each hit, let's say, and just learn from it and grow and just push forward with it, you know.
Thanks for listening to the Kickstart Garage. This show is for entertainment purposes only.
This show is for entertainment purposes only. No one on the show has provided investment advice. The information provided by the Kickstart Garage podcast should not be construed as investment advice. The opinions and views expressed on the Kickstart Garage podcast or those of the participants do not reflect those of the host or sponsors. The Kickstart Garage, its producers, sponsors, hosts, and guests shall not be liable for losses resulting from the investment decisions based upon the opinions or viewpoints presented on the Kickstart Garage.